Tonight, I've entitled the message, In 1 Hour. You will find that phrase in verse 10, verse 17, and verse 19. In 1 hour. Tonight, we finish up our look at Babylon the Great. In 1 hour, the hammer of God's judgment falls mightily and with finality. It is almost as if with the rapidity of a guillotine falling, that it strikes, so much so that people are in awe, not only at the magnitude and power of this judgment upon the earth and upon Babylon the Great, but at its finality. There's a lesson for us to learn in this. You realize now that we are dealing with the second of two chapters set aside as parenthesis chapters. That is, the action is paused, as it were, in the program of the judgments that occurred during the Great Tribulation period for God to say, hold on a minute, I want to tell you some other things about events that are going on. And we finally get all of this information on Babylon the Great. And as I mentioned to you last week, she is called Mystery Babylon the Great. So it isn't that we should be surprised that there are things about this that we could not know except God would reveal them. It should not surprise us if we don't have necessarily every question answered about this, because even though God has seen fit to give us some understanding of this, the mere fact that she is Mystery Babylon the Great indicates to us that there is perhaps something about this that we cannot fully grasp. We talked about the fact that Babylon in the Bible. And always remember that we're depending on the Bible to help us interpret this. Always remember the teaching of progressive revelation. That is to say, God starts off. We know the first book of the Bible is Genesis. Doctrines are revealed to us in seed form. Other books of the Bible over time are written and given by God, which expand upon this until finally we get to the end of the Bible. The book of the Revelation is almost in some ways analogous to the book of Genesis in the sense that we have Alpha and we have Omega. We have the beginning and the end. And so it shouldn't surprise us at all to find all of that revelation coming to a head, and that we would be dependent upon the Scriptures which have gone before to help us understand. Everyone knows that the book of the Revelation involves symbols. We shouldn't be afraid of that. Literature uses symbols, and the Bible is no different. It's just that when we get to symbols, we have to be careful that we have some limitation that we place on how we interpret those, lest we just sort of get carried away and say, well, this sounds like this to me. Well, if we do that, we're hopelessly lost. We have to depend upon the imagery. And so, thinking back to our series on Sunday nights, really over the course of a number of years now, when first we went through the book of Isaiah, and then we talked about great texts in Jeremiah, and we spent time looking at Ezekiel and Daniel to lay the foundation to do this study that we're doing now. And Babylon, in the Old Testament, kind of coming to us now as emblematic, if you wish, a figure ready to be used of the quintessence, really, the fullness of man in his opposition to God and his people, whether religious or political. And so we have two chapters, and I took pains last time, I think, to point out to you chapter 17 at the end of verse number 1. This chapter is still dealing with Babylon the Great, but especially emphasizes the religious aspect. It's almost like there are two different aspects. Each of them deserves a focus. And so at the end of verse number 1 of chapter 17, I will show thee, the angel says, the judgment of the great whore. And so now you have the religious aspect, the harlot as opposed to the true bride. The culmination, that's why understanding that figure is so powerful, because once you understand the symbolism in the Bible, and many times in the New Testament we're given this, of the bride of Christ, his people, being the wife of the Lamb, and understanding that that is the exact opposite of a whore, a harlot, a prostitute. One is designed to be faithful and pure. The other is known for her allures and for her temptations and for her unfaithfulness. So obviously it has to do with the religious system of the last days. But then we found out in chapter 17 that the religious system isn't totally separate from the political system. Because what did we see? She rides the beast. The beast is emblematic of that empire of the last days. That's a figure that's clear. Revelation tells us that in and of itself. And so for a time, there's an alliance between the two. Hence, last week we talked about religion and politics in the tribulation period. But you know, after a while, and I used this figure of speech last time, you try to ride a bucking bronco, and you already know the proposition you have yourself into. The animal, whether it's a wild ox, a cow, a steer, or a horse, doesn't want you on its back. And the kings of the earth, the political system of the tribulation period, doesn't want anything really to do with the great whore, except as they use one another. And we found out last time that any time that happens, there's always a mutually corrupting influence, which is the problem with all of that. Now, though, turn your attention to the political aspect. So it's like we have to kind of look at two sides of a coin, and they're both relevant, but looking at them separately kind of helps us maybe. Now we're looking at the city. It's really interesting. You will find the word city mentioned in chapter 18 seven times. I'm not going to read those verses again, but in chapter 18, verse 10, verse 16, verse 18, and verse 19, and verse 21. Seven times in those verses, the word city is used. So as in chapter 17, the emphasis is on the great whore, though we're given insight into her commingling for a period of time with the kings of the earth, the political system. Now it's the city. The empire has a capital, but it's more than just that. And I don't know that we can really understand completely what form this will take. We can gain some insight into that. The emphasis now is on the political and commercial aspects. And so tonight, as always, I want to do a little something with significance. I hope you'll forgive me if I don't do as much as you'd like, but it's impossible to try to, and it's impossible to try to get to some significance and draw some spiritual application without us sort of maybe not doing as much justice as if we just did this in a home Bible study. I want us to notice a particular spiritual lesson as we move through this and get to the end, and that is this, if you'll just try to focus, and I'll repeat it, of course, the folly of living for this world. Poof! It's all gone. Literally. Poof! It's all up in smoke. You will find the kings of the earth as they marvel at this, saying, in one day, verse number 8. And three times over, you will hear it in this chapter, verse 10, verse 17, and verse 19. They marvel, in one hour. It's all gone. There's something in that to think about, folks. Even as God's people, when we think about what we're living for in this world. Let's do our survey. First, in verses 1 through 8, we'll try to describe what we have here as an anticipation. You have another angel, so there is another angel in contrast to the one who gives the pronouncement about what chapter 17 is about and its contents. And that angel declares the judgment, the city's judgment. So in verses 1 through 2, we find that. And it's really interesting when we look at that, that once again the image of fornication is used for Babylon and her allure. But this time, the focus is on the riches. You know, lots of things, folks, are tempting in life, right? And here in this life as Christians, we face temptations of all kinds. But there are many things that tempt us, and that's why the figure of wine and or alcohol, as well as fornication or sexual temptation, is so vivid to us. Somewhere along the way, temptation will meet you. And temptation can be strong and powerful. And that image is used again here in verses 1 through 2. Verse 2, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk. Both figures, with the wine of her fornication, are brought out again, just as they were in verse 17. Because it isn't just the allure on the religious side, it's the allure on the commercial side, what is a part of this world and living for this world. The language of verse number 2 really draws on Old Testament background, as I took some trouble to mention because we're told of the finality. We're told that once this is done, Babylon is no more. Babylon is completely uninhabitable such that it becomes, as we have described there, a wilderness. Verse number two, a habitation of devils and a hole of every foul spirit and a cage of every unclean and hateful bird. It's just gone. But Old Testament background, and I know we don't have a lot of time, but I want you to see just a couple of these, okay? So would you turn with me to the book of Isaiah? We'll try to be as economical as we can, but it really is important for you to see that what God is doing and that this is not just something that is haphazard. But this is drawing on all of this background in the Old Testament. So one of the prophets I mentioned that we took some time, actually did a study of the book of Isaiah, verse number 19, look at this in chapter 13, in Babylon, the glory of kingdoms, the beauty of Chaldea, excellency of the Chaldeans' excellency shall be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. It shall never be inhabited, neither shall it be dwelt in from generation to generation. Neither shall the Arabian pitch tent there, neither shall the shepherds make their fold there, but wild beasts of the desert shall lie there, and their houses shall be full of doleful creatures, and owls shall dwell there, and satyrs shall dance there, and the wild beasts of the islands shall cry in their desolate houses, and dragons in their pleasant palaces. And her time is near to come, and her days shall not be prolonged. Do you see how all of this is just drawing upon that? Let's look at one more. Let's turn to Jeremiah. Jeremiah, of course, lived through the times and was in the land when Nebuchadnezzar's forces, the forces of Babylon, came and ravaged the nation of Judah and took captive the city of Jerusalem. So there's so much in Jeremiah as well. Just in chapter 51, verse number 39, therefore, the wild beasts of the desert with the wild beasts of the islands or coasts shall dwell there, and the owls shall dwell therein, and it shall be no more inhabited forever, neither shall it be dwelt in from generation to generation. And one page over to chapter 51, one verse from there, verse number 37, and Babylon shall become heaps, a dwelling place for dragons, an astonishment, and an hissing without an inhabitant. It just laid the groundwork. It just set the stage for this to become a powerful figure of what Babylon is in the last days. So we have a little anticipation that's given to us there as the angel announces this. Next, in verses 9 through 20, we have a reaction. And I want you to notice some things. I have to summarize. But the reaction comes from kings, merchants, shipmasters. Kings you'll find mentioned in verse number 9. Merchants you'll find mentioned in verse 3, 11, 15, and 23. Shipmasters you'll find mentioned in verse number 17. They all alike are aghast. It is as if their breath is taken away by what has happened. They put so much stock in it. So much stock in the things of this world. And in 1 hour, it's gone. Verse number 9 says that they lament insofar as their reaction is concerned. Verse number 11, 15, and 19 says that they weep. It's all gone. She has lived deliciously, and now it all is no more. I was interested in something that I think many of us can identify with tonight. This particular post to a blog was by a young lady. And I have no idea what the background of the lady, save as what she gives, but what she had to say about something that happened to her resonated. Maybe it will resonate with some of you. This is what she had to say as she reached out on her new blog. So I accidentally deleted my blog last night, instantly losing everything I worked hard for in an instant. I'm devastated, and I've shed many tears, But now it's time to reestablish my blog, and I thought I'd reintroduce myself. Computers are wonderful when they're wonderful. I never will forget when I was... My wife loves to tell this story about when we came to Huntington, we had a computer. She just doesn't get a chance to tell it from the pulpit too often, so I'll do it for her. We had a computer, and she said, you know, you should really take that computer to your office. We only had the one, it was our home computer. And she said, you should really take that computer to your office. I said, what would I do with a computer in my office? I don't know how long it took me to get to this point, but there was a time when I was doing something. I can't remember the exact circumstances. This is really a dateable expression. The word processing program that I was using was WordStar. I can always tell a document that I did in that just by looking at how it printed out. Usually a dot matrix printer or some unbelievable relic of the past like that. And I don't know what I did. I had a program that saved sermon outlines. I don't even remember how it all was. And I hit a wrong button. And poof, like that, I lost 900 and some sermon outlines. Just gone. More, I think, were gone than that, actually. We found someone and took some stuff down to them, and they recovered some of them for me. Because, as you know, when you erase something, it's really not erased. You do know that, right? There is hope, but it takes somebody with some equipment and know-how to accomplish that. I got all of them back at that what I had lost, but some 900. So if I took you and showed you on my computer today the place where I have my sermon outlines, that is the electronic copies, it starts with 900 and something. I have hard copies, but part of me resonates with what that girl was talking about. In an instant, poof, it's gone. Finally, in verses 21 through 24, we have an affirmation. The angel says it's like a stone sinking. There's something awfully final about that, and violent too. In fact, that's what the angel says. He uses that very image when he says in verse number 21, and a mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone and cast it into the sea, saying, thus with violence shall the great city Babylon be thrown down and shall be found no more. And we say to ourselves, well, that's a striking and an interesting image. But yeah, it too is drawn from the Old Testament. So humor me one more time as we look at this. Let's turn back to Jeremiah chapter 51 once again. This is startling to see this, really. God has laid the foundation. We are able to understand this if we're careful to know the Scriptures. At least we're able to understand something of it. Jeremiah chapter 51. And let me read the last verses. Listen to this. This is quite interesting. Remember, Jeremiah was left in the land, but the nation was deported. People went into captivity. So this is sort of interesting. Verse number 59, the word which Jeremiah the prophet commanded Seraiah, the son of Neriah, the son of Maaseiah, when he went with Zedekiah, the king of Judah, into Babylon in the fourth year of his reign. In other words, captivity. And this Seraiah was a quiet prince. So Jeremiah wrote in a book. So he gave it to him. He was reserved. So he wrote it in a book to give to him to take. Jeremiah did. All the evil, verse 60, that should come upon Babylon, even all these words that are written against Babylon. And Jeremiah said to Seraiah, when thou comest to Babylon and shalt see and shalt read all these words, then shalt thou say, O Lord, thou hast spoken against this place to cut it off, that none shall remain in it, neither man nor beast, but that it shall be desolate forever. And it shall be when thou hast made an end of reading the book, look at this, that thou shalt bind a stone to it and cast it into the midst of Euphrates. And thou shalt say, thus shall Babylon sink. and shall not rise from the evil that I will bring upon her, and they shall be weary. Thus far are the words of Jeremiah. Startling, isn't it? All drawn right out of what we're prepared for in the Old Testament. And one final comment before we move to some significance. Despite the severity of this judgment, yet it is so richly deserved. Verse number 13, I paused on that just a moment in my reading. In her were found slaves and the souls of men. And verse number 24, as we read, and in her was found the blood of prophets and of saints and of all that were slain upon the earth. You say, I thought it was just the great harlot that persecuted God's people. Oh no, my friend. Have we not read back in chapter 13 about the beast out of the sea and the beast out of the earth? Have we not read about this final world dictator? Have we not read about his sidekick, the beast out of the earth, his religious sidekick, his religious henchman? See, the two are kind of co-aligned for a time. Haven't we read how this beast out of the earth, this religious sidekick who attempts to reinforce all that the beast is doing, and with signs and miracles and wonders deceives the people of the earth, and that image of the beast he has almost creates the illusion that it speaks and has life. We've not read about all of this already there. Chapter 13, verse 15, and he had power, that is, this religious sidekick, to give life unto the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause that as many as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed. It's beast worship or die in the tribulation period, the great tribulation period. And he caused all, both small and great and rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their foreheads, and that no man might buy or sell save he had the mark or the name of the beast, or the number of his name. They participate in this together, the religious and the political. Finally, the religious aspect is destroyed. The great whore is destroyed. God puts it towards the end of the tribulation period, as we saw last week, into the hearts of these kings to give their power to the beast. And the beast, no longer needing and tired of the great whore riding his back, casts her off and she is destroyed. That leaves the city. That leaves the political aspect. That leaves man still in his organized rebellion against God Almighty to be dealt with. And that's what we have here. In verses 22 and 23, six times it says, no more. The city shall be no more. All right, beloved, let's take a little breather here for a second. Let's transition. Not a lot of time left. But let's talk a little bit about what we can draw from this. Lots of things, okay? But obviously there's not time. Not time to talk about all the things that we could, but there is significance, and as I said to you earlier, it's the folly of living for this world. There is a spiritual lesson that can be drawn from this. The impermanence of riches is emphasized in the expressions of suddenness, for in one day, an hour, they all go up in a poof of smoke. It's all gone. And as I've tried to point out, it's just, even the people of the earth, when they stand back and look at it, the kings, the sailors, the merchants, are just awed. And when we talk about a poof of smoke, that's not just a figure of speech. Look at verse 9 in the chapter. And the kings of the earth who have committed fornication and lived deliciously with her shall bewail her and lament for her, for they shall see the smoke of her burning, a poof of smoke. And verse number 18, the same thought. And cried when they saw the smoke of her burning, saying, what city is like unto this great city? It's all gone. And what else have they lived for? Because you see, these people who have received the mark of the beast have already set themselves in their opposition to God, in their determined rejection of God, and in their allegiance to the beast. And it is not that there are not people saved during the tribulation, because scores and multitudes of people are saved during the tribulation. But I rather suspect that there's an element that is as bad as it's ever been. Oh, sure. I mean, there have been periods of time when God's people have been persecuted. All of it gave rise, of course, to the saying that the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. Persecution is not new. But think about it for a moment. Think about when all of God's people are removed. If, as we understand the Bible, that the rapture has occurred prior to this and God's people have been removed, save they who come to know the Lord and attempt to live for Him, but many of them are martyred, because when we read this about everybody who refuses to receive the mark of the beast, it's like basically like you've got a big bullseye painted on you. Now, can you imagine? Just let me give you this way to think about it for a moment. Can you imagine what it would be like in America today, as bad as it's getting, as unbelievable as it's getting, if there were no Christian influence and all Christians were gone? Can you just even begin to fathom the accelerated pace of the inward spiral which would lead to our destruction? Because basically we're imploding, beloved. I hope you realize that. Just hate to say it. But you know, if you have eyes to see and ears to hear, you need to do that. It just takes time. The Roman Empire did the same thing. The Roman Empire imploded on itself in its profligacy, in its giving way to all of the allure and all of those things that conquest and power and prestige bring. It takes time sometimes, but it's basically what happens. Babylon and the tribulation conditions, I think, for us tonight, dramatically serve to illustrate the greater truth of the folly of living for this world. The nations cooperating with the beast have lived deliciously. We're told that in verse 3 and verse 9. While those refusing to receive the mark of the beast are denied even the simplest means of commerce. This is what this is all about, commercial. That's what they bewail. No one's there to buy anymore. No one's there to partake of all these goods. And they lament because all of these things are wiped out and gone, poof, in 1 hour. And yet, the people who have received the mark of the beast, the people who have refused God, they have been free to engage in commerce, to indulge in the wealth of that system, and to partake of all of those delicacies, while God's people have been scattered, persecuted, killed. All because they refused to face, to receive the mark of the beast, denied even the simplest means of commerce. The allure, of course, though, for the believer of the riches and wealth of this world is always a very real thing. That's why, if you look quickly at verse 4, if temptation were not real, there would be no need for another voice out of heaven to say to God's people, "Come out of her, my people, that ye be not partaker of her sins, that ye receive not of her plagues." See, it's easy even then to look at all of those things and to be tempted by those things. There's always an allure. Temptation's always real for the believer. And let's talk just a quick moment about riches. The Bible is clear in warning us not to be captivated by the riches of this world and the folly of living for them. And Paul writes to Timothy in chapter 6 and verse 9 of the first letter and says, "But they that will be rich fall into temptation and snare and into many foolish and hurtful lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition." And people always misquote the Bible when they say the love of money, or money is the root of all evil. No, my friend, money is not the root of all evil. It's the love of money that he says is the root of all evil. And if you live for those things, whether we're talking about the lesson that we can draw out of the graphic things that happen in the great tribulation with Babylon the Great, or whether you're just talking about how easy it is for you and me right now to kind of settle in, coast along, get caught up with the wealth and the things of this world, but you pay a price for that. And I'll tell you what the price is. The price is a loss of power. What do I mean? Well, let me tell you the story. I've told this story before of the time when Thomas Aquinas, the great theologian, church father, was invited by the Pope to come and to see some of the things that were there. And it just so happened that Innocent II, who was the Pope, had out before him a large spread of material things, particularly money. And the Pope said to Thomas Aquinas, "You see, the church is no longer in that age in which she said, 'Silver and gold have I none.'" Sounds like us. Aquinas said this in response, "True Holy Father, neither can she any longer say to the lame, 'Rise up and walk.'" It's a cost, see? And the cost of the gain is our loss. Instant gratification, get rich quick. And if it's not something like the lottery or gambling or something else of that nature, and I know I've quit preaching, gone to meddling, it's the abuse of credit cards. You can have it now. And every day they bombard you with some new credit card offer. I get so sick of those things, but I tell you one thing that I really delight in. This is kind of perverse, I guess. But my kids are old enough, the two that are still around, and they have jobs. Well, somehow that leaks out. It's just kind of osmosis, right? And so all these things come in the mail. Ruth Coleman, John Coleman, City Card, this card, AA Advantage, all this stuff constantly coming in the mail. This is payback time. You know what I do? I put it where I put all their other mail that comes. I come home at noon for my lunch, a little break here from things at the church, and I get the mail. And I bring it in. And I put those things there right along with the tax collector or whatever else they get. Or a good letter or a good note. I put it right there. And they come home, "Man, these are these credit cards offer." They fume and fuss. The other day I put the Zacchaeus, my good buddy Carl Lang. The notice came about the per capita tax. At least he's good steward. He put all of them in one envelope. Thomas Coleman, Rebecca Coleman, Ruth Coleman, John Coleman. So I took the Thomas and Rebecca. I always pay that right away. And then he sits on the thing forever, drives me nuts. I put that thing, and I put theirs. Well, Ruth's kind of gotten used to it. We've been down this road a few times with her. I used to always go to bat for them when they were in college. Even though somehow the word never got through, I'd go down and I'd take a little opportunity to chat some with Carl Lang. I like to talk. He's a decent guy, really is. And I was in there, and I told him about Ruth's trip to Bolivia. He was interested in that. And he says, "Okay." And I said, "Look," he's still in college full time. So, okay, he marks it. You know, it's all done. But now it's for real. He's not in college anytime anymore. I put that thing with his other stuff, John's. He came in and saw that thing there. "I already paid that once this year." Yeah, you have to do it twice. Isn't the adult world interesting and fun? You see, the outcome of living for those things is not good. Lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, the Bible says. Not on earth where moth and rust doth corrupt and where thieves break through and steal, but in heaven where neither moth nor rust doth corrupt and where thieves do not break through and steal. And if you think the imagery of poof, gone, up in smoke, is extravagant, and this is written to Christians, 1 Corinthians chapter 3 and verse 12. "Now if any man build upon this foundation gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, stubble, every man's work shall be made manifest, for the day shall declare it, because it shall be revealed by fire, and the fire shall try every man's work of what sort it is. If any man's work abide, which he hath built thereupon, he shall receive a reward. If any man's work shall be burned, he shall suffer loss. But he himself shall be saved, yet so is by fire." See, the gold, precious, silver, and precious stones, it abides the fire. It's the things we've accomplished for real by God's power, the things where we've really given our hearts to Jesus and we've made an attempt, despite our stumbling efforts, to try to live for Him in this world and do the things that He bids us do. You know, you do that and there's not a cup of cold water you can give in His name, but what He doesn't notice that. There's not a tear you can shed, but He doesn't have it in His bottle and written in His book. But sometimes our motives are mixed. Sometimes we get drawn away, the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes and the pride of life. But the Bible says, and the world is passing away, and the lusts thereof. But he that doeth the will of God abideth forever. What do you have in your portfolio tonight? Let's open it up and look at your holdings. 50 shares of gold, 50 shares of silver, 50 shares of precious stones, 3,000 shares of wood, 5,000 shares of stubble, 10,000 shares of hay. Oh. All gone. Just like gains in the stock market are realized and unrealized, they are on paper until they're realized. As long as they're on paper, they're unrealized. You and I need to think about who we're living for and what we're living for. And I close with this. It's the story of a man who lived on the West Coast, and he lived in poverty. Until one day he was notified that he was the only living heir of a British nobleman. So what do you think he did? Here's what he did. He went to the clothing store and bought the best suit he could find. He went down to the airline office and he bought a first-class ticket to London. That's my style. If I could afford that, I'd do it at least once. Just to see how the rest of them live. He returned to England in style. Why'd he do that? Because he believed, and he acted on the belief. Folks, let me leave you with this tonight. So we say we believe. We say we believe that the world is passing away. We say we believe that all of those things are just temporary. But we live as if we were going to be here forever. We manage our resources as if they were all our own. And the truth be known, there are certain aspects of our life that God has just not admitted to those particular areas. Be careful. And be careful of the illusion that, well, I'll get around to it. Once in a while that happens. Most of the time it doesn't. Because be not deceived, God is not mocked. For whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. Ladies and gentlemen, we have been given some insight into Babylon the Great. We have seen the finality and violence and power of the final judgment of God that comes. That's a future date. But for right now, it ought to be a lesson to us. All of the kings of the earth, all of those who looked towards that great commercial center and all of her wealth and were lured by that, tempted by that, lived for that, and they behold from afar in 1 hour, and they weep and they lament because it's all gone. Ladies and gentlemen, tonight, let's not let that happen to us.